Join Johannes, a necromancer of some little infamy, and his charismatic brother Horst in the many adventures of the Cabal brothers on the Necromancer's Deathcast. From circuses to dreamlands in turn-of-the-century never-never England, author Jonathan L. Howard brings his dry wit and exceptionally clever writing to this series of the most intense and tumultuous proportions. Rise up, all ye undead, and rejoice in the wonder that is the Necromancer's Deathcast.
Welcome to the Necromancer's Deathcast, brought to you by Free Flow Rambling. This is episode 3.12, Altruistic Evil, where we're discussing the book Johannes Cabal, the Necromancer. My name is Tanzan, and I'm joined by Amber.
Hello.
And Jess.
Hey, hey.
Chapter 12. Cabal returns to Penlow on Thurs and is depressed by its idyllic nature. He runs into Barrow and the two have tea together, discussing topics ranging from the carnival to death itself. Cabal gives Barrow tickets for him and his daughter, and then is introduced to Liani. Later, Barrow forbids his daughter from attending the carnival. Chapter 12, in which Cabal discovers some places are nice to live in, but you really wouldn't want to visit.
And yet, I completely disagree with it. Oh. I think the title would work better if it was like, in which Cabal realizes some places are nicer to visit, but you wouldn't want to live there. Because I find this whole chapter is him being like, he doesn't like it. Like,
it's like talking about how wonderful everything is and it doesn't really sit with him.
Well, yeah, there's later in the chapter he says, he's like, where do these people go to retire? Like, this is already the best of the best, right? Wouldn't that make the chapter title the inverse then?
No, see, you expect the inverse. There's the humor. Right? It's a nice place to live, you know, because anybody else would describe it as such, mm-hmm. right? Oh, what a lovely place. But Cabal doesn't want to visit.
Yeah. Cabal, I'm sure. Yeah.
Chapter starts with Cabal returning to Penlow on Thurs. He is deeply fatigued. Seems like he's almost wearing down at this point.
Well, he just kind of stepped over some pretty large moral lines there.
Right.
I like one of the, as he heads away from the police station, he pats his pocket to ensure and reassure himself that the contract hadn't disappeared. It said he drew a deep breath. Some part of him had been rather hoping it might. So immediately we start off with regrets. I've had a few.
A little bit of conflict.
Subconscious yeah. or not, he's done some heavy mental acrobatics.
Right. So Cabal starts examining the town and finds it idyllic, and that totally depresses him, which is, you know,
Cabal.
Yeah.
First of all, what's a sousaphone?
I don't know.
Okay.
I should know this, but I
don't. Me too. I feel like it's something like a saxophone, or is it that thing that like the Whovilles?
It's a tuba.
That's what I was thinking. I was like, right? Sounds like something from Dr. Seuss.
Yeah, yeah. The Whos in Whoville play the sousaphone, I'm sure.
It's a tuba.
Is it?
Looks weird.
Ah. See?
Jess, Dr. Seuss.
You just ruined all the magic of this for us.
That's what I like to do. That's why I'm here.
Telling truths.
But you know,
As
you were saying that sentence, I was suddenly struck with like how JLH would describe us, the way we pronounce things or perceive things about this book, and the way that he just like writes everything insulting. I'm like, I suddenly feel like in another timeline, he is insulting us just with this interpretation. I'm like, this is how you write out a nice little town.
Wait, am I the psychotic with a dog?
This is how we pronounce the word sousaphone or cabal or, you know.
Right.
I feel like it would give them at least a little a giggle or two just hearing us trying to muddle our way through some of the language. What?
Yeah. Meanwhile, I try not to think of what the author thinks of us.
I follow him on Twitter and it can't be positive. It's based off how he reacts to the rest of the world.
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh. Please don't hate us, JLH.
I love you, JLH. Your insults on Twitter are the best.
So yes, Cabal runs into a cheerful postman, considers all the quote-unquote strange things he'd encountered in his life, and none of these, however, had filled him with such a sense of hidden threat and foreboding as this polite and cheerful postman. All I need now is a friendly vicar and I'll know I'm in trouble.
So I couldn't help myself. I did look up all of those strange things that he describes.
Okay.
There's some interesting stuff there. So he says he had run for his life from the Guardians of Solomon's Key. Now, there is a book by Aleister Crowley on King Solomon, who purportedly could use magic to summon, bind, and control demons. So that's one possible reference. The other one is it might be a reference to a 1986 video game.
Oh?
Wouldn't surprise me because he's a video game designer.
Uh-huh. JLH.
Yeah. JLH, not Cabal.
So what was the video game?
The Solomon's Key.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I say that as if I played it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Solomon's Key.
I was eight.
The next one.
Old. Shut up.
The next one, he's avoided the attention of the gargoyle Bok. This is a Doctor Who reference. Bok is a gargoyle statue that was brought to life by the powers of the demon Azazel and briefly became the aid to the rogue Time Lord known as the Master.
That has got to be his most modern reference yet.
And studied, although been careful not to blow a bronze whistle upon the words, qui est iste qui venti.
Are you sure?
Then it.
Definitely?
Yes, definitely. We're deeply inscribed. Oh, and that's a short story. Oh, whistle, and I'll come to you, my lad. It's a ghost story by British writer M.R. James.
Deep.
Yeah.
Wow.
So many things, just little
scholar.
Tidbits,
yeah.
Embedded everywhere.
It's true.
At this point, it's almost like, you know, Hansel and Gretel walking through the forest and you're collecting your breadcrumbs. You've really run out of pockets at this point. You're like, you could have dropped a little less bread. At this point, okay. Message received.
Yes, the priest invites Cabal to Sunday service.
Mm-hmm.
I think I also put a note, is this indicative of Cabal's feelings regarding spirituality as well?
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, this whole chapter sort of touches a little bit on the spirituality portion of it.
I was going to say, not just the spirituality, but just entirely Cabal's, not just spirituality, but just kind of like the code of conduct that makes up who Cabal is as a person.
Moral code?
Moral code, but even more just like, you know, like his own ethics, morals, decisiveness, his own thoughts, like not necessarily like, you know, in the way of like personality, but just in the way like he interprets the world, period, you know, like just how he reacts to everything. It's this chapter is almost less of Cabal reacting to the world and the rest of the world just reacting to Cabal.
It's true. Like, well, I think that gives you a lot of insight into sort of, yeah, who he is, right? Mm-hmm. So like, I like the point where it said Cabal felt a need to check his own smile in a mirror to make sure it was still the thing of fear that he'd carefully cultivated for years. And that he'd carefully cultivated for years, I thought was really interesting, because we hear a lot in sort of throughout the stories that he's got this icy cold smile and this smile that makes little kids run away and the whole thing. And it's like, he's worked on that.
Right. See, and that totally could have been taken as a throwaway joke. But I have notes on that one too, looking a little deeper into it, I sort of assumed that Cabal had sort of become a creature of the incidences that had happened for him. So he's so focused on things that he ends up being this cold and focused sort of a man. But this statement sort of goes against that and saying that he's actually cultivated and he's tried actively to embody that.
Right. So, like, was he always a necromancer, or did he actually work hard to be that level of creepy?
It's that question of nature versus nurture, you know? He really presents himself as it being his nature, but you're finding this is almost his own, you know, learned behavior rather than just who.
See, and I wonder, in terms of the nature and nurture, like, you know, I think about, you know, people on the spectrum, for example, you can find those who are really good at, or on the autism spectrum, those who can... who are really good at science and maths, and yet they still cannot understand social cues. And I wonder if Cabal doesn't have some of that, where it's like this sort of like, I don't really know how to deal with human beings, but I'm phenomenal at, you know, maths and sciences and like all of these very sort of analytical arts, right?
Well, one of the interesting things about this world and maybe just JLH's writing in general, but is that you've got this unreliable narrator in Cabal. Where he's very, you know, set in his thinking and his ways and everything like that. And for the most part, you're following his story and getting things in his world. But you have this ever-present changing narrator and you're constantly following other characters who are not Cabal. You're constantly jumping back and forth between what is the truth going on in this book? You know, like how often are we watching Cabal maybe have bad social interactions versus Cabal legitimately just, nope, this is a normal human interaction. I am a normal human male. This is exactly how any normal human man would, you know, present in the situation.
Yeah.
And you're with him and you're like, yeah, 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 yeah. Okay, okay, okay. Like you can be evil and still be like, you know, reacting to the world passingly not evil, you know, Whereas the rest of the world, or resurrected, I'm trying to think of, like, you know, the train was personified, the station was, you know, characters who aren't, you know, sentient, but are in this book. I don't know. I don't know what the word is that I wanted, but the point is that, like,
natural.
Yeah, like, either way is that you've got all these different, it's almost like, you know, having 45 unreliable narrators and you're just trying to, okay, something's happening. We're being presented a whole lot of,
See, and I think that actually adds to it, though. You know, like, you're never really clear. Yeah.
It's a great story. Totally. And obviously, you know, the nice thing about fantasy, sci-fi, supernatural books is that you can always kind of have a little bit of that mysterium. And what's really real is part of the theme in general.
Yeah. Well, and it's like reality, right? You know, you can meet somebody and you sort of have this initial impression. But then it's like you hear other people's impressions and even their own impression of themselves. And you start to sort of put that puzzle together and be like, okay.
Yeah, I don't agree, because I just know for a fact that everything that I see and think and do is correct. So I don't have to worry about everyone else's because they're just clearly wrong,
yeah.
Right?
And see, I don't agree because I think you're a pompous ass right now.
Beep.
Just
what were we saying about that vicar? What were we saying about that vicar?
Get back to the vicar.
Back to the vicar.
So the vicar invites Johannes to attend one of his services. Johannes,
I didn't wake you up from it.
Won't be there in the and informs the priest he's a Satanist, which the Satanist is like, okay, whatever.
Yeah, Cabal might have admitted to preferring spring or summer or fondness for chocolate digestives. And are you happy? The vicar questions.
That is a brutal line.
It is.
If you're ever going to fist bump, high five, chest bump a priest, that was the time to do it, because that was hardcore.
In my head, I just visualized you chest bumping a priest.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Cabal answers honestly, though, to that and tells him he isn't happy and essentially a victim of circumstances and plans to give up Satanism as soon as possible.
It's more like work experience.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think it's really interesting because then we compare and contrast of the town church attendees' lives to Cabal's, you know, like people would enjoy going to church. He found himself envying them. What was wrong with him? Right. So it's like, why doesn't he enjoy these things that sort of the average Joe or Josephine enjoys, you know?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily that he doesn't enjoy it or saying he doesn't enjoy it, but that he's almost saying more that he kind of wishes for that connection that they all have, you know? He's wishing he could integrate himself in a community.
Simpler life.
And he's, you know.
Simpler life, or deeper connection with God. There we go. There's a...
A deeper connection with God, I think, could be a very well-made point.
Would help
case
this man.
In this chapter.
Has he heard the good news yet? Has no one knocked on Cabal's door yet?
Like, I think he's actively...
Where's the watchtower when you need it?
Actively throwing away those flyers. You know those mailboxes that are... what's the fucking goddamn word? Solicitors, or I'll fucking, you know, charge you blah, blah, whatever. He's like fully like plastered on every side of his carnival life.
Well, doesn't he let his fairies eat the
I was
going
to say, I think
anyway?
The garden probably eats all the visiting, all the visiting religious interests.
Oops.
A little Jehovah snack.
Yeah. After that priest encounter, up to everything up to this moment, the narrator has described as idyllic and wholesome. And it not only seems to upset Cabal, but it seems to put him off, really off balance. Everything from the priest's unbiased response, picturesque church, now a child that seems to almost ignite his paternal instincts.
Yes, an insane urge to find a good woman, settle down, and have a couple of kids, one of each, lit upon him like a thing out of a nightmare. I laughed at that because, again, it's just such a very obvious sort of like that compare and contrast of like this idyllic sort of, you know.
Yeah, this is his horror for some reason.
Yeah. Right.
But we find him yearning for it, though.
Yeah. Well, the grass is always greener, maybe.
Yeah. Mm.
Don't you have anything to say, Jess? You're always right.
Just gotta look.
I will admit, I zoned out to research The Color Purple.
That's why she's always right. She's got Google.
Real crack, real quick, bring me back in. I'm not usually asked for my opinion. I usually just, you know, I'll zone back in and give it when I feel like it. Usually not cued for these.
I like how they also, like, it says a short expedition into the churchyard resulted in a hasty retreat as his feet started to smoke. He'd forgotten about the danger of consecrated ground in his soulless state. Combusting footwear was an experience that tended to stay with a person. I laughed at that.
Right.
Only because there's so many, it's interesting, some of the tropes he plays fast and loose with. There's some things about vampirism and sort of the standard ideas of the occult that we have. Some of it he adheres to, the writer, and some of them he just tosses straight out the window.
Right.
And I find it interesting that, like, you know, Cabal's feet would burn on consecrated land as a necromancer.
I didn't expect that when I read that. I was like, oh, well, that's funny, but really? I expected that of his brother.
Yeah. But then in the soulless state, I guess that kind of makes sense. Yeah. Just reminded me of all the times I put my feet on the fire when
I think
camping.
It's less about
how he... I've had my footwear on fire before.
Just his footwear?
Just my footwear. True story. I've burned many shoes on campfires.
Anything for those toasty warm toes.
Fact.
But I think, I think it's less that he's a necromancer and more of how he became a necromancer, which was he gave up his soul to become a necromancer. So I think, you know, a more pure necromancer who went through the right proper channels and didn't skip straight to devil soul selling might not have all of the challenges that Cabal has, but he kind of, you know, he really leaned into the necromancer thing, you know?
Right.
Pure necromancer? I'm like, how does one become a pure necromancer? Like, is there a school for this?
Listen, like, I don't know.
Google it.
I don't know. But it.
You might be right.
Has been, at least to my interpretation, hinted at the Cabal didn't need to sell his soul to Satan in order to become a necromancer, but that he, you know,
shortcut.
Basically fast-passed himself to necromancy.
Right.
So had he not done that, as he's saying even now, the entire point of this book is to get back his soul but remain a necromancer, right? Mm. So clearly, you can have one without the other, right?
True.
So it is my interpretation that, you know, had he kept his soul and been a necromancer, he would maybe not have all of the issues that he is currently having right now. Although, I guess, you know, we can now be convinced that Horst was not on consecrated ground this whole time. That graveyard, that church, whatever. Clearly, if there was anything there, it's God has abandoned it. Because him and Horst were both able to, you know, be there.
Well, but is a graveyard the same as a church, right? Like,
well, we had this talk at the beginning when we had that chapter, right? It was a difference between a graveyard and a cemetery. One has a church and is more holy, and one is a body dumping ground.
What? We had this conversation?
I don't remember this conversation.
We recorded that episode months ago. So long ago. You people are old and do not remember, but I do.
Huh.
When do we meet Horst? What do you think that was, like chapter 4? Chapter 3?
Huh. Sure. Now I'll have to re-listen to our podcast.
Right.
As you should also. Take a look at our Patreons.
We're in a real role today, aren't we?
We're recording the Dresden one or something like that. And every once in a while, we're like, so take that, Amber. And it's like, she doesn't fucking listen to this.
Wait, what? Why are you not telling me that? Conversations.
I swear, like, it's every other episode that we're like, so there, Amber. But it's like, who cares? She's never going to hear this.
Tanzan, how are you allowing this to happen? Are you not defending my honor in my absence?
Because you stopped reading of like point A, B, or C. And Tanzan will say, like, she stopped reading because of this. And we're like, it gets fixed in this book, Amber. Read it. But you're not going to. But you should.
You want me to read Dune. You want me to watch Critical Role. You want me to finish the Cabal series. You want me to.
I have the time to do it.
It's true. So Cabal runs into Barrow, who tells him of the woman's innocence. The baby is alive. The doctor thinks it wasn't dead to begin with. Or to start with, that the poison was really a drug that caused some sort of catatonic coma. Isn't that remarkable?
And convenient.
Exactly. So I like that Cabal shifted his weight carefully from one foot to the other. He didn't want to make the contract rustle against the other piece of paper he'd brought away from there. I put in big, big letters. Guilt!
Yeah.
Maybe. Is this when the guilt creeps in? Is there guilt? He didn't seem like it. He's a man on a mission. There's not a lot of guilt being expressed here.
But. I think even just the fact that he hasn't fully dismissed it in and of itself is something for Cabal. Because we've seen thus far, he's very good at just being, all right, job done, delete. So the fact that it is on his mind, I think is, if not guilt, at least, you know, something tugging in his head.
I think he struggles with that this in this chapter. He really starts to sort of see what his life could have been like, I think, in Penslow Thirst.
Meet a new man this chapter.
Besides the vicar?
I mean, Cabal himself.
Oh.
So Barrow mentions his general dislike for the Kerrigan Crow, and Cabal calls the crow to him, which it complies. Barrow is surprised by that the crow actually listens to him, And Cabal confides that there's two ways to get the animal to obey, that it can answer to kindness as the first option. And Barrow guesses cruelty is the second, but Cabal is surprised by this and suggests threats instead. And I think this is a bit of a telling gauge of Cabal's moral compass at this point. I might be overreaching or guessing at this, but he's not really, he's willing to threaten somebody or something into compliance, but he doesn't expect to follow through with an act of cruelty, is what it seemed like from that shock that he had from it. And I also was kind of curious to what the symbolism of a crow might be, if that has any sort of bearing on the story itself. So when I was looking into crow,
aren't they the messengers?
Symbology. At least in Native American respect, the crow symbolizes cleverness, intelligence, adaptability, teamwork, transformation, and psychic abilities. I think Cabal seeks these abilities, but has to force his will to achieve them instead of going through the way of kindness. So he's really like grasping for it. Kind of like I am right now. Alternatively, crows are given a bad reputation. They seem to embody fear and death and messengers of the dead kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And this is also kind of a parallel to Cabal. He wishes to end and command death.
Absolutely. I thought there was a really interesting point when Barrow says, I thought threats were for blowhards and cowards. And the response is, when you're dealing with people, yes. Animals seem to take them in the spirit that they are meant, though. Like, I thought that was an interesting point, because it's like people will use threats as a bluff. Whereas animals, it's not necessarily a bluff. If a cat raises its back and its tail, you're very clear that you push your luck and it's going to strike, right? So that honesty of intention when it comes to animals, I thought was a really interesting point. Yeah, and I think it also gives a bit of deeper insight into Cabal as well. It's like he thinks a lot, and he himself is much deeper than, you know, so he's like, you give him a threat and he's picking apart like a crow. What exactly does that mean, right? And I don't think that Cabal threatens lightly either.
Right.
Like, he's more animalistic in that way, I guess.
Right.
True.
Well, it seems like he identifies with that base animal instinct.
Yeah.
And a little less how to have a grasp on people. So I think that's why maybe that animals more appeal to him that way.
Well, and the whole idea, it's like animals won't attack out of cruelty as much as necessity. Right. So it's like, I think that's another reason maybe Cabal was taken aback by Barrow saying cruelty. It's like, no, cruelty has nothing to do with it. It's about, you know, you're pushing things too far. Mm-hmm. You've now overstepped your boundaries with me. Mm-hmm. Life, said Cabal quietly, it's like a wisp of smoke in a tempest.
I love that.
I know.
He meant so much. And it was just kind of interesting how he misunderstood how the question, how are things? What is life like? Yeah. And it just goes.
He gets deep instantly.
Just this honest and vulnerable answer, too.
The musical Avenue Q. I always love, like, people always say, it's like, how's life? Disappointing. And no one ever gets the reference, but I'm always just like, it's like anytime anyone's like, how's life? Disappointing. It's like, I get you, Cabal.
So the two continue to talk about life, death, and fate. Barrow asks if the fortune-telling machine he saw at the arcade couldn't help.
That entire phrase about the fortune-telling machine at the arcade, right? I don't know, like, the way it's presented is, like, usually people who respond, usually in books like this, when, like, magic or the supernatural is real and acknowledged by everyone, which it is in this book because they all believe in Malificaris, means that everyone believes in a supernatural to a degree, generally tends, to, I don't know, when they're presented with magic, they tend to take it seriously, or they accept it as real, they'll accept it as mystical or magical. But I find it's so funny how in this book, everyone almost treats like Cabal's magical or supernatural, like they're speaking down to like a child always. For whatever reason, when it comes to Cabal, it just seems like, oh, isn't your little toys in the carnival a hake? It's not any helpful for you. Whereas like this entire sentence to me just seemed like a less seriousness to Cabal's.
Like people don't take him seriously, or they don't.
I don't know, just like
they underestimate him?
A lack of respect for his sort of supernatural involvement, I find in this presentation. It's just, I don't know, the way it was worded, I just find it to be, I don't know, Cabal gives this whole, you know, the future remains a mystery right to the moment it becomes the present, and he's all being like, you know, Cabal's whatever, and everyone's just like, aw, but what about your little fortune? And it's just like, you know, even you got Dumbledore and Gandalf and all these other mystical, magical or whatever, people are like, ooh, and everyone tip Cabal is like, okay, anyways. Anyways.
See, I wonder, though, if they actually know, like in the next chapter, and sorry to, I mean, it's not much of a spoiler, but like there was one comment in the next chapter that says, you know, when somebody actually starts putting the puzzle pieces together more fully, and it says, yes, magic exists and it was very rare in this modern times, was sort of the comment. So it's like, it's almost like a more magical version of today's time where, like, yeah, we know it exists, but we don't actually encounter it very often, you know? So, like, I think that I wonder if it's like that patronizing that you're talking about, or if it's that they don't really automatically jump to the conclusion that he's some sort of supernatural being or that he has any power whatsoever. He's just a dude with a carnival.
Well, I don't necessarily mean, you know, even the character so much as just the narrator or the author, just the presentation in general. It just seems to kind of, you know, it disregards it constantly. You know, it's like you build up this magical and it gets extinguished constantly, you know?
No idea. Okay. We have no idea what you're talking about.
Huh? Whoa, am I on the wrong book?
You know, this isn't the Dresden podcast, right?
Everything is a Dresden podcast. I'll turn it all back to that.
So there's one phrase that was close by to that point. He looked up at a print of an 18th century hunting scene and fell silent. Cabal abruptly said, "I disapprove of hunting," which, that's the very thing that Cabal is really doing. He's hunting out 100 souls. And that's kind of a paradox to his expressed value, what he's just expressed, and his actions. So it's like, I think everything in this chapter just seems to be at odds with one another. Like this what he's seeing, and it's just the opposite of what he's going for, and but he still wants it, but he doesn't.
Yeah. Well, I think the word paradox is a good one. It said in one of the quotes, Barrow was struck by the paradox. Cabal was prepared to serve him his tea, but not to check whether he liked milk or lemon. So, you know, Cabal, as I put in brackets for my notes, Cabal is juxtaposition unknowable, right? So it's like, there's this, well, yeah, he's not a hunter and he abhors hunting, but at the same time, is that not what he's doing with the souls, as you said?
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, it's like, Cabal's willing to serve his enemy T, but like he doesn't even bother to question how you take it. You know, like it's this interesting sort of, on one hand, you think you can kind of figure him out, and then no.
So is this Cabal imagining no one else would have their T any other way? Or is he just fully analyzed everything about Barrow? He's like, you are absolutely a lemon and milk kind of man. I just know this about you. I know how you take your tea. Everything about the way you walk and talk, you are a milk and lemon man.
Brian, I wondered about that too, because he is so detail-oriented. Like, everything is meticulous and controlled. So why wouldn't he have already sort of used his observation skills to go, oh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and how much of this is being filtered through sort of Barrow's eyes as well? Because this is Cabal speaking. I used to like Lapsang Souchong in my adolescence. He's talking about the tea. He looked Barrow straight in the eye, and Barrow almost expected him to add, "And now you know my secret. You must die." You know, so it's like it's interesting that.
Sure. Yeah. For all we know, Barrow made a reach for the milk and stopped. So then, like, Cabal finished off the task for him. And Barrow's like, whoa, motherfucker, how do you know I like milk?
Yeah, it's interesting that, like, even as Cabal is sharing, you know, some details of his past and, like, opening up and trying to be vulnerable or seeming to be vulnerable, there's still this uneasiness about it.
Oh. Yeah. Right? You know, when you've made, like, your judgment.
Yeah, and Barrow's sitting there going, okay, and my throat could get sliced at any second. You know, even though he's telling me about his childhood, even though he's serving me tea, even though he's having these deep conversations about life, love, and the pursuit of happiness with me, any moment now, this man could just, like, flip.
Right.
And, you know, Dr. Jekyll me into oblivion.
So your case is that it says more about Barrow than Cabal.
I don't know. Like, I think that Cabal is an unknowable. I think that he is, in a lot of ways, throughout the, like, all the series, you're constantly questioning, is he good? Is he bad? Is he right? Is he wrong?
X-level threat.
Yeah, like, it gets, mm-hmm. You know, it's like, is he the good guy or is he the bad guy? And I guess the thing that always has me coming back is that there is no answer to that. You know, it's like, and I like having no good guys and no bad guys, because I don't think that, you know, the world isn't black and white. It's, you know, even the good guys have faults. Even the bad guys have altruistic reasons.
The nice thing about books generally is that you don't pick, you know, the good guy or the bad guy. You pick the most interesting character, right?
Yeah.
And then you write about them. But it is really like a Western theme of writing that we have more morals and resolutions and typically the good guy saving the day. Whereas if you go to literature in other parts of the world, you don't necessarily need a moral. You don't necessarily need a happy ending. They just tell the story as it is, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot more, you know, especially more original folk tales. For example, didn't necessarily always have a happy ending or a moral ending or even, you know, rhyme or reason. You know,
like, Christian Andersen is dark shit.
He gets dark, but even if you go lesser, even if you just do like Aesop's fables, like sometimes you've got like these classic children's tales that are really nothing, you know? It's like whatever you're talking about, the fox and the hare and the turtle and the rabbit, like for all these different things, like sometimes you've got a story and it becomes a classic and we know it nowadays, but the actual story itself is essentially nothing, right?
Yeah.
And it's very much like, you know.
Or it's a children's rhyme about, you know, smallpox. And we still sing it on the playground today.
Listen, right? When a banger's a banger.
That's my jam.
Hit it.
Ring around the rosy for everyone.
Pocket full of posy. Pocket full of posy.
So do this.
Oh, that was awesome.
The free flow rambling remake of all your favorite childhood tunes.
Wheels on the busca.
Red Rover.
So while they're having tea, Barrow.
Should I bring it back? Okay.
Barrow continues his inquiry into Cabal, and he's analyzing every nuance of his actions. He notices the precision with that Cabal uses with the knife and the scone. He discerns he should have been a surgeon and not a carny. Barrow calls Cabal on this, and he states that he wouldn't have pegged him as a carny in like 10,000 years. So he's very, very astute and has some really great observational skills. So.
Sorry, I just want to throw out this whole like moment of them at the tea shop, too. Fully reminds me of like one of those like SNL skits. When you've got like two characters and they're just like staring at each other like so intense. It's like, who are you? You're going to break. You're going to break. Another one is looking at him like, who are you? You're going to break. What are you thinking right now? Right. And they're both just like really like, you know, you've got like the in their head monologues happening and they're both just like so intense staring at each other from across the table. Just
and all they're doing is buttering bread.
And like, yeah. And the rest of the cafe is just completely normal day at Starbucks. Doesn't give a shit about this like showdown in the corner. Right. Fucking hardest day of their lives ever trying to, I won't give anything away to him, but I'll learn all his secrets and I'm not going to tell him anything, but I'm going to learn everything I can in this moment. And yeah, like the rest of the world is just like, la, 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 la. Just two guys having tea.
Totally.
Well, it's comical that they're having, they're at a tea party. That's just wonderful.
There's definitely a doily somewhere nearby.
I laughed so hard when like, so Barrow is asserting that Cabal would make a better doctor or pathologist than a carnival owner. And I love Cabal's response. No, said Cabal, I always take my work home. I've got several clowns under the bed and a man who can belch the anthems of 12 nations in the wardrobe. Like, I'm like, I think, again, it's sort of that the intensity of what you were saying, like these two guys in a corner. And then he starts talking about clowns and belching anthems, you know, like. It's that constant sort of tension build and then completely deflates it with like one well-timed sort of sentence that you go,
committed,
right.
Committed to the bit.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah. So Cabal offers Barrow and his daughter tickets to the last night of the carnival. He produced a card from thin air. Learn a couple of conjuring tricks, Horst had told him. People like that sort of thing. Okay, once again, people like that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Hear it again and again.
And Cabal listened.
Well, and this is why I say I think he's just socially inept. Like, yeah. He's brilliant, but at the same time, he has to be told what people like constantly. And he's like reiterating it just to be sure that he knows. Knows that, okay, somebody told me people like this, so I should probably do this. You know, like.
I think the part of that that made me laugh even harder, though, is Cabal put the extra ticket in his pocket. It was intended to vanish, but he had so little practice at that, to the untrained eye, it simply looked as if he was putting a ticket away in his pocket.
Tricky.
Tricky.
Yeah, see, and this is where I get it. Watching Cabal talk now, he had a sensation reminiscent of watching somebody open a Chinese puzzle box. Part of it was wonder at the complexity. Part of it was curiosity as to what lay inside. I think Cabal is the big puzzle box himself.
Mm-hmm. And this is where sort of Cabal really opens up his opinion on death. Just sort of, he doesn't try to hide anything. He goes off on how doctors call release. It's just a talk, doctor's talk for failure. And
I thought it was interesting that he's just sort of like a bored, disappointed sadist and then spiritual transfiguration. These are your choices after death.
Yeah.
Right. So
he sees no absolution in death whatsoever. It does, like, there's whether he ends up in heaven or hell, he wants nothing to do with either of them.
Well, and he says, I despise waste. That's all.
He doesn't make a point to say, like, oh, it's a waste when you're young. He seems to think it's, like, a waste at all. You know, at this point, we haven't met any proof that Cabal wants to live forever. He hasn't made any points that he wants to be immortal or anything like this. He just thinks clearly, for whatever reason, wants to be able to bring people back to life. Doesn't think the end has to be the end so soon. But this whole conversation makes him seem like he is after immortality, final point. Which is, to me, a whole other ball game than just bringing people back to life until they hit old age.
So by then, they're just useless to you anyway.
I think when you hit 60, what else are you going to do, quite frankly?
I'm at least 20 years off right? that then.
Yeah. No.
Thank God.
I think if you can't, you know, work for the government and be part of a cog in a machine, just fucking die. We don't need you anymore.
Wow.
It's just, what's the point? Just give up.
Oh.
We need trigger warnings on this one.
All I want to do is work every day of my life, and then I want to fucking die.
I was just thinking that Barrow is a really wonderful counterbalance to Cabal. Mm-hmm. Like he's got enough intelligence and intuition to see through Cabal's charade. Mm-hmm. Trod.
No, it's true, and I think that he's got the intelligence to actually verbally spar with Cabal, which, you know, so far, other than Horst, I don't think Cabal's really met his match. You know, in terms of anybody who could actually stand up to him and be like, question yourself, you know, like, check yourself before you wreck yourself there, Johannes.
Right. Well, and Barrow even, like, calls Cabal in on his hatred of death, and Cabal tries to sort of backpedal him. He said, and Barrow says, that's not what sounded like a moment ago. He sounded like a man that would kill death if he could. So he knows that there is some underlying reason.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of kind of what kiboshes the conversation, because he pushes a little bit too far and says, no, there's something else here.
Yeah.
You there's a reason why you abhor death so much.
Hey, Cabal, you weirdo.
But, you know, Cabal being an open book and all, he's not going to tell Barrow that.
So Cabal starts to leave, and then Barrow follows. But Lene comes around, his daughter. We learn a little bit more about Lene's character as well with the statement, with Lene, one day was tomorrow, except on the occasions when it was today. So she's very no-nonsense. Like, she's like, yeah, let's get this shit done.
Right.
And can I just say, Leonie is, like, such a pretty name. I like it a lot. Yeah. Good name.
You don't hear it often. I don't think this is the only time I've ever come across
Same.
It.
I think I knew one Leonie once. Maybe. I could be totally BS.
Fever dream.
Yeah, probably. I thought this was interesting, too. Barrow is reminded of a past standoff with a rabid dog, realizes that Cabal is looking at Leonie.
Right. And we get a little bit of foreshadowing right before that, too. Something lay darkly over the familiar happiness that Leonie inspired in him. Like a single small but impenetrably dark cloud on the face of the sun, he turned his head slowly in Cabal's direction. It's like, ooh,
boom, boom,
ooh. And that's where he sees him staring.
I think it's interesting to note as well that when he sees that look on Cabal and thinks of the rabid dog, and at the beginning of this chapter, Cabal wasn't quite sure if his smile was coming off right.
Interesting. Yeah, so, good point.
To have at the end of this chapter basically come back to that. What is going on with your face?
Fix your face.
Fix your face.
Fix your face, Johannes.
So it's an interesting choice that Barrow decides to actually introduce him to Cabal instead of, like, well, getting her the fuck out of there.
Really an interesting choice.
How much of that is just politeness, though? Like, how much of that is, you know, social decorum versus actually wanting to introduce your daughter to a madman?
If she'd walked up to it, but at this point, unless I misread in my head, there's distance between Cabal, distance between Barrow, and distance between Leonie.
So that's how, like, I took it too, yeah.
Yeah, the three of them have got this triangle and a square, and Barrow calls both of them back to him, which is an even weirder thing, because it's like, yeah, like, it just seems out of nowhere that, and again, I would pin it on social decorum had he been standing with one or the other and the other one was still called, but he could have essentially just fully left it as is, and he takes this moment to introduce the two of them together, which is just, for me, the weirdest moment. Like, just completely,
here's my snack, I mean my daughter.
For me, it shows success that Cabal was able to lower Barrow's defenses, because he came into this coffee shop thinking, like, I don't trust this man for shit, I'm gonna go accuse him about I know his police station shit. And by the end of it, oh, I want to introduce you to my daughter. Like, it seems like Barrow just for, like, moment just
disarmed.
Watched off. Yeah, totally disarmed. Just for, like, a second, he had, like, a crisis in confidence about his gut against Cabal. Hey, you know what? You just told me about your childhood and poured me tea. This is my daughter. What the fuck did I just do?
Yeah,
that's a good point.
I don't know if you ever watched White Collar.
I think you should have probably.
I started watching it. Never followed through with it.
Oh, here's more things I have to watch for your benefit.
Yeah. But I'll give you a quick recap until you get there.
Thanks.
Essentially, it's just one more goddamn cop show. But this time, the premise is that the FBI, you know, at pilot episode, has to figure something out. And so the main FBI guy goes and gets his, like, most prolific criminal capture he's ever done out of jail to help him. Because he's like, this is the only guy smart enough to help us. And it turns out that, like, this guy he put in jail finally is just super smart and pretty much becomes, like, his confidant on everything. He, like, essentially, like, the premise is, like, he's got to wear an ankle bracelet at all times. And, like, the FBI gets to know, like, his whole life and everywhere he goes and everything he does. He's not allowed to step out of bounds, and he just helps the cops and will lower his life sentence, right? But as, you know, as the seasons go on and on and on, the FBI constantly, like, you know, gets used to this man coming to his house for dinner and being a part of the FBI family and just always being there, and they become friends. And criminals constantly, like, you know, every season finale, he, like, betrays the trust and goes and does something, you know? And then the next season starts up with the FBI being like, I trusted you and I gave you this freedom and blah, blah, and I'm putting you back in jail and I'm giving you a harder time and I'm giving you 10 ankle bracelets. And the guy's like, I'm so sorry. Like, I just, like, had, like, a bad day. And, like, it goes through the whole season again. By the end of the season,
I'm not bad. I'm just drawn this way.
Right? But it's like, you know, pretty much like, you know, the beginning of every season is the FBI being like, you're the worst criminal ever. In the middle of the season's like, we're best friends. And then the end of the season, the criminal being like, I'm going to finally run away from this place and be free. And then, you know.
Wow.
Next season starts up and the FBI is like, I found you again, bitch. And yeah. It's actually a really good show. I'm really, you know, I'm putting it down to its basic qualities because that's really all it is. But the point is, this sort of thing, too, is like Barrow's like, fuck, wait, I don't like you. I forgot for a second.
I trusted you briefly mid-season.
Yeah exactly.
Yeah, he instantly regrets it, too. Like,
in the same sentence that he's introducing Cabal to his daughter. Stop, stop, stop. That whole metaphor, you know, a train wreck that you can't look away from. And he's the one driving the train and tying his daughter to the tracks and offering up Cabal the train to the situation. And it's like, oh, dear, you are in a mess.
Yeah.
You know, you fucked up.
You fucked up. You really fucked up.
Well, and that's a regular thing, too. Like, I've seen that a few times where people say things, reduce things within the context of these characters that they later go, oh, I really shouldn't have said that.
Yeah. Oh, this entire podcast for me.
I really shouldn't have.
Oh. Take it back. Now.
I'm like, wait, are you saying you never should have done it? No. Okay. group hug time.
Yeah. Let's just pause the episode. Let's do some group therapy real quick.
Why don't
Amber,
you like us, Jess?
That insult I gave so five old. Episodes ago, I'm sorry.
Is it because I have gray hair, Jess?
It is.
Is that why you don't like me?
It is.
Okay. So as you were saying, Cabal encourages them to come to the carnivals last night. Barrow's intuition just tingles like crazy. And the quote I wrote was, he was distracted by the sure knowledge that there was something going on that he didn't like. He could taste one of his famous hunches, and it had the flavor of a beached whale. So he determines he's going to keep Leonie home and away from the carnival that night. Barrow head back home to have a good old-fashioned argument about it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So Leonie does mention that the Cabals had vanquished Rufus Malificarus, the necromancer.
Right. She sees them as heroes.
Yeah. But I really like this life after death after life. Something in the words provoked the glimmer of an idea. In Barrow's mind, cogs of pure thought started to form from the chaos of unordered data. So, like, this is sort of, he starts, okay, life after death after life. Interesting comment, dear. Interesting that here are these people who have run-ins with, you know, well-known necromancers in other towns and, you know.
Starts putting all those pieces together.
Yeah. Yeah. The cogs.
His old work life is kicked into gear again.
Mm-hmm. Back on the case.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, and this comes up quite a bit in the next chapter as well. That's sort of like, you know. Again, a bit of foreshadowing here, but it's like Barrow kind of puts two and two together and goes, holy crap, I'm dealing with a necromancer. But here's where the inklings kind of start.
Well, he's really at odds with him with what he's thinking on Cabal.
Yeah.
It's a quote here. I actually think he's a very moral man. I don't think that he's using the same morals as everybody else. I think this was it. He painted himself into a corner, and 1,000 lazy reporters and ever so sincere politicians had rendered the only word that he could use comically melodramatic. I think Johannes Cabal is evil, but that's kind of at odds, like, with the, he's a moral man, but he's evil.
Well, but having morals doesn't necessarily mean having quote unquote good morals. You can have very, very bad morals, right? Like, I'm thinking about, this is me thinking about my gaming characters, but it's like whenever I want to be bad, I bring out the rogue character because I can do things. He's got a moral compass, but it's a little different than most people, right? Because it's based on a more selfish every man for himself. Therefore, what is good for me is enough.
It's kind of that, you know, lawful good or evil neutral. Exactly. Or like, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, it's still a set of rules that you live your life by.
Bingo. That's what I'm saying.
But yeah, not necessarily, you know, it could be lawful, but not good. Or it could be, you know, evil, but not chaotic or whatever, you know.
So it's like, you may have morals that say, you know, you can kill someone, but don't do it on a Sunday. And that's still a moral. Right? It's still a code that you live by, but...
Thank God we meet on Sundays.
I know. Well, I wasn't going to talk about my moral stance on things.
It's Amber's only free day, apparently.
It's when I won't kill you for the ageist comments.
Join in next episode. Well, I'm really nice to Amber.
As you hear sharpening of whetstone in the corner. Just wait till Monday. I know where you live. Podcast.
Can you play it just every time she's on air? Always slightly in the background.
Yeah, add it as an Easter egg to your Dresden casts every time
every
you
time
mention
Amber
me.
Talks,
or every time you're like, oh well, you know, reference to Amber. Suddenly the whetstone sound comes up. I will kill you in your sleep.
Please take back my misery.
I kill you.
Let this suffering end.
Oh my God. We do need a group session. Here. Give us a hug. Give us a hug, little one.
My mother never hugged me as a child.
I never got a red pony like I asked.
Yeah, it ruined my life.
Barrow doesn't use the term often, but he does think that Cabal is evil. He is of another order altogether. So Leonie acquiesces, says, okay, fine, I'm not going to go to the carnival, but, you know, typical young daughter, we all know what that means.
Hey, now.
I want to go to the party. You can't, says the parents.
At this exact moment, I think Leonie is fully intending to obey her father.
I think that if a carnival came to town, there is absolutely, in a boring town, like this idyllic whatever, as a young girl, I'd be like, F that, I ain't missing this night.
In this moment, I feel like he makes his case successfully. But, you know, as we will see.
Well, I think he makes it successfully because he burns one of the tickets into the fireplace, or so he thinks. Yeah. And so it's like, end of discussion, there's no ticket available for you, dear daughter. That said, as he turned his back on the fire, he failed to see that the ticket he had thrown there flutter up the flue. So the enchanted ticket continues into an awkward turn, ending up in Leonie's room, lo and behold, and onto her desk. And, oh my God, I couldn't stop laughing. It found itself a good, obvious position and practiced, looking alluring.
I like that.
Like, in my head, I'm seeing this ticket, you know, sort of do the what do you call it, the 1950s pinup sort of, you know, shoulder wave with the hips slightly, you know, off to the side.
The thing is, though, is that, like, quite frankly, there's no, you know, better advertisement than a carnival ticket, you know? Iconic imagery is carnival ticket, whether in real life or movies or whatever like that. Like, they are always just, like, the most fantastical. A souvenir on their own, you know? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, a carnival ticket practicing looking alluring, I imagine, has got to be well within its nature.
This concludes our episode 3.12, Altruistic Evil. Thank you for listening. You can find us online at freeflowrambling.com and necromancers.ca. There we have links to our other podcasts, social media, and other fun tidbits. Please subscribe if you like what you're hearing, and please consider supporting us through Patreon to keep the undead alive and to see more content. We are Free Flow Rambling, and remember, reanimation is trending.